Maybe we can do this together because it is really an important reflection. I'm asking you to come to, for all of you, to, in your own silence, to speak with me, in other words, to actually, we're all doing this reflection. You are listening to me, but I'm also responding to your questions in some level, in sort of in terms of connection with you. I am talking about things that interest us. So one thing we can say about time is, I think most of us feel quite stressed by time. You can see that weekends, have been created in England just to kind of cool out for 2 days in between weeks of lots of works, lots of schedule and time-bound reality. Well, we had to be in time, we had to be, present a certain time at different place with different people and so on. And time, I never really knew exactly what time was until I started meditation. And timeless. I never knew what that was either until I had an experience without meditation. And so I could say that there was a point in my life when I felt that my whole world was victimized by this time-bound reality of existence. There was a, for one thing, we age. There is a time factor just by the very fact that our body changes. And this realization at the age of 30, when I realized that there was a reality that kept on moving on, and there was nothing I could grasp, there was nothing I could hold with me. That was a recognition of this reality that was beyond my control, beyond my capacity to choose or to decide, and it felt that this time-bound reality was had a particular kind of flavor. It was the flavor of change. Constantly, night, day, the seasons of our human life, from babyhood, birth, to adulthood, to death. There was this constant factor that things keep on moving. And there was, I felt quite distressed by that. Because even though I didn't want to be a total control freak, there was a sense of being quite helpless. And the pain that came from that. You could not stop aging, you could not stop being sick, you could not stop... you could not stop being part of that law of change, of anicca, as we call it in Buddhism, the law of anicca. And I still remember one day I was actually seeking some sort of responses to my questions, to my many questions I had at the time on, what we are here for, what is the meaning of existence, what's the point of being alive. What's the purpose of having to witness this life of changes of the existence that is so seems so temporary and so evanescent at some point, completely kind of fleeting and elusive? So this brought me to one day I had this experience. It was interesting because I was doing some retreats. I used to spend time just trying to be more in a timeless realm. Even though I didn't know what timeless was, but really I was drawn to those Christian monasteries, churches, retreats, places, anything but workplace. There was a sense of wanting to retreat from time and have a kind of break from time and spend some time, a period of not constricted, not bound by this the beginning and endings of my life, the timetables, and I was quite addicted to it. Actually, like the sort of the high that you get about having to do this, that, and at 10 o'clock I do this, and 5 and 6 and 11 and 12, and there was something very exciting about time too. You know, something very... And the thing that kind of alerted me was the fact that I felt actually quite addicted to this notion of having to do things with lots of beginning and ending and changing and so on, being quite addicted to this capacity to live my life also in a sort of exciting way, sort of moving from one thing to another, being born into this and this and that, and that was kind of interesting. You know, going on retreat one weekend and then spending the whole time not doing other things, you're totally unlike a retreat, you know. And so there is a kind of, I realized there was a kind of addiction to that, and I also questioned that. What is it that makes me so, so kind of bound by this desire to have my time, my diary filled with things? What is it that, you know, if I had my diary empty, I would start maybe panicking or feeling that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do in life? You know. And what I noticed is that when I paid a little bit more attention to that, there was a definite sense that I was driven by something. I was driven. And what was driving me is this fear of being still. Is a fear of stillness, the fear of silence, the fear of timelessness, the fear of not moving, being here now, and perhaps realizing that that's all there was to it. So there was, you know, I became very curious about this, these fears. Now, as we observe in ourselves, you know, what is this, why does this stillness will conjure up fear? Why is it that we need to be so busy, so constantly running from one thing to another, time and time again, you know? And so this experience once, I remember, was particularly striking. I mean, I've had a several of those, but this one is kind of funny. So I was just, I didn't like washing up very much, but I was married at the time, and I was in the kitchen doing washing up. And I didn't like it. At some point during the washing up, something very ordinary, I realized I was totally at peace. It was so striking. And it's not that I was, you know, neurotically sort of excited about things, you know, there was a lot of peace in my life, but suddenly there was a different kind of peace. And this peace seems to be like, really, as we say, time stood still, you know, there was a sense of, and in my kind of cynical way, I said to myself, I was kind of alone, and I said, I bet that's God. It's kind of half serious, half cynical, you know. So I bet that must be God, because I was kind of really searching. I was going to Christian monasteries. I was not religious at all, but, you know, if it wasn't Buddha, it could have been Jesus or God. You know, I was looking for some kind of response to this human existence. So it was funny, this moment of total stillness where I watched myself, even though I was not practicing meditation, I remember being quite observing this moment where I suddenly realized, oh, I feel quite happy. I'm one with the dishes, I'm one with the plates, and I wasn't reading Zen books or anything like that, you know, stories about this kind of things, about suddenly being enlightened, having Satori experience in the middle of cleaning something or other. I didn't have that kind of conditioning, but I just noticed there was the stillness, the happiness, the oneness, all at once. And I thought, that's interesting. I wonder what that is. And of course, the whole flow of mind just went on again, back to what I'm going to do tomorrow and what I did not do yesterday and how am I going to come to finish my work and all the rest of it, worrying about it and wondering, the whole sort of ordinary flow of mind came back, and with all the sort of time-bound reality of past, future, missing the present, past, future, missing the present, and so on. So eventually that led me to be very, very curious about this moment of stillness, which wasn't an ordinary moment. It was this very, I don't know how to explain it really, because it's really beyond words. It's not something you can, package and talk about very much. But what I recognized later on was that it was actually, an aspect of mindfulness. It was what mindfulness is about. Even though that was a privileged moment of mindfulness, because it was mindfulness and also this total agreement of my mind, body, spirit, you could say, all being here present. Most of the time we are mindful of going here, going there, planning this, planning that. We are mindful of our worry, we're mindful of our anxiety, we're mindful about many, many things that keeps on moving and changing and so on. So, isn't it important to bring up this question, what are we doing with this time-bound reality? How it affects us? Are we a victim of it? Do we feel victimized by time? Is it stressful or is it peaceful? Are we at peace by our days and nights, which are relentlessly passing? How well am I spending my time? This is one of our daily reflections. Days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? That's one of the 10 reflections in our teachings. Can you hear me still? Yeah? Okay. We can't escape time, because here we are. We are born in a time-space reality. We are, we have to adjust ourselves to this reality. We are part of community of human beings who are all experiencing the same thing at some level. If you are late, you notice people complain about you. If you if you're not aware of time, you'll have a lot of enemies. If you're not aware of time, even though you might be a forgetful professor, but still you could really make a lot of unhappy people around you. So we do have to respect this time-bound reality. We do have to honor it at some level. And we can only honor it by knowing its opposite. In a way, as long as we are attached to, identified with this time-bound reality, then, for one thing, this very identification brings a lot of suffering. And that very suffering, if we're not really aware of it, will bring simply our inability to deal with life as it is. If you suffer and you just identify with suffering, identify with the deluded aspect of the mind, then you can't really see clearly. Not seeing clearly, you can't respond clearly. Not responding clearly, you'll be in trouble. You get yourself into a lot of difficulties. So, not that you have to respond clearly all the time, but the clarity of the mind doesn't come from whether you feel confused or not confused. It comes from that capacity to be aware of the confusion rather than identify with it. So most of the experience of time is really what we call a psychological time. We remember what we did in the past. We are affected right now by everything that happened to us in the past. We are planning the future. We are planning what we're going to do in the next few days, next few weeks, next few years. next few lifetime probably, some of you, you know. And as we are planning what we are doing in the next lifetime, on the next day, then we are not aware that we are carrying with us a whole perception of time which is burdensome, because it's not a time which is needed right now. Right now, we don't need a lot of psychological time. We don't need to carry with us our neurotic tendency at this very moment to inform the next moment. It's not necessary. We have a choice, in other words. It might be a bit of work to get to that point of being able to choose, but there is a choice. We don't have to fall into the trap of being totally, under the sway of our past and under the sway of our response to the future, which is unfortunately often founded in fears, and in the fear of not knowing what will happen, the fear of not being able to call somewhere the creator of our world and say, what are you planning for me next week? Could you tell me? Or get a crystal ball and find out. That's why, those people who have the capacity to read crystal balls are making a fortune these days, because so many of us, and not just amongst the non-Buddhists or people who practice meditation, but also amongst those as well. You know, how many of us wants to know the future? Even though the Buddha said, the future is dependent on now, on the present moment. What you bring into the present moment will condition the future, etc., etc. Still, there's an enormous desire to know what's going to happen to me next. We love the idea of finding out what is going to become of me, even just the next day, the next hour. In fact, a lot of our life is just planning the next moment. Not just in thoughts, but in all our feelings, in everything that we experience at this very moment now. It's all geared up to have the next moment program in a way that we like. Because time is also dependent on what we like and what we don't like. Let's say when we like something, we will want time to stretch endlessly at infinity. When we don't like something, we wish time will reduce itself to a split second. Don't we? Isn't it true? So we do manipulate time as well, unknowingly most of the time. we do manipulate it. So if something is going to be unpleasant, well, we'll spend a lot of time trying to either sweep it under the carpet or put it in an old drawer somewhere, or an old drawer of our mind. You know, we have lots of little drawers and little kind of piece of furniture in there in which we accumulate all our little memories and the thing we like, we don't like, and the thing we wish would be present now and are not, and so on. So we do have a way of manipulating time a lot. Somebody calls and you like them very much. Say, oh, how wonderful. And you talk with them for an hour or two on the phone quite happily. Somebody calls and you don't particularly like them and say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm really busy now. Could you call again? So this is a psychological time. You know, it's like being left with this unpleasant feeling and perception to one person. Then we are conditioned by that. And so we don't even want to, we manipulate time, so we spend as little possible time with them as we can. And then we feel time. This is one of our greatest ability. Feeling time. Feeling. F-I-L-I-N-G. You know, we feel time as well, but feeling time. How much energy just spent into doing that? And And it goes very well with the fact that time is money, doesn't it? I mean, we always have such a good excuse to fill time because we say, well, I've got to earn money, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And yes, that's true. At some level, we do have to earn our living and we do have to, you know, make our, have to, you know, have a salary at the end of the month. But how many hours are spent just trying to figure out how to use our time in such a way that it will be productive, not spiritually particularly, but on the material level, productive. So we are also, time and in this material plane are very much intertwined. There is this immediate sense that not time is just money, but also time is this capacity to control the material world. So eventually this interest in just finding out how time affected my life and how it how I responded to it as well brought me to becoming interested in meditation. And you know, there was, at first it was prayer and then meditation. You know, even though they seem so different, still it's an activity which brings you into the present moment and teach you how to be present and how to learn to find some peace in the present moment. Now, when we talk about eternity, timelessness, it has a poetical tone to it, which is very attractive. We like the word eternity, don't we? Eternity sunrise. It's a joy, isn't it? So eternity is not so frightening for us. Look, everybody is smiling. When I say eternity, it's like there's something kind of beautiful about this. But it's all pointing to a dimension of this universe which is not very well known. You know, we don't really get a taste of timelessness very often, do we? Even when we practice meditation, even when we dedicate a whole lifetime towards meditation, it's still quite hard to keep, to train the mind to recognize that there's nothing else but the present moment. Yes, but, you know, tomorrow I have to do this, I have to do this. You know. Yes, but tomorrow depends on now. You know. So we don't forget time, because we do, we are, in conventionally speaking, you know, part of this convention. But we can use it. We can use it rather than misuse it. We can actually, you know, it's useful to sort of have an alarm clock in the morning to get you up at the time that you wish, so that you can be in time at work, so that you can, you know, do your work properly, that you can meet your friend at the time that you've decided. You know, if we didn't have any clock or anything like that, we would be in... Can you imagine a world without clock? That would be very interesting. Without time. And yet that's how the, what we call, quote unquote, the primitive culture, you know, lived. Just, but then they had other ways of determining the time. So you can see that even if we didn't have clock or watches or whatever, we still would feel the movement of time just by the fact that the sun rises and the sun goes down, by the fact that there are the days arise and then the night comes, and by the fact that there are four seasons in our part of the world. In other parts of the world, there are no, there may be one season. Or two seasons at the most, other parts of the world. So I like to talk now a little bit more about, you know, timelessness. Now, when I began to practice meditation, I was very busy planning my life, very busy finding a direction, finding a way of, you know, and then from one day to the next, there was always a sense that, oh, I have missed that day, I haven't been too successful, I'll try my better tomorrow, or I'll try better next time. There was always a sense of having to carry this person here who is not quite right now or, you know, in the past and needs to improve in time. So the whole notion of improvement, of not feeling adequate right now, of not feeling good enough, etc., is a mark of this relationship we have with time, you know. And it's so ingrained in us, we're so absolutely convinced that we have to improve all the time. Absolutely convinced that there's something wrong right now. So convinced that actually we see it, we see something wrong. We are very capable of creating a wrong person right now so it can be improved. Because we just like to be busy bodies. We just love busying ourselves, trying to do something. So with time, we can be a doer. We can be somebody who's kind of... And the whole society, the whole education, all the messages that we get, whether it's from the media or from our culture or from our education, all the messages is about, you know, not good enough now, I've got to improve, you know, I've got to, you know, get a better TV, a better car, a better computer, or whatever. So this, it is, we are very much in the constant, you know, resonating constantly with this experience of time, you know. So when we consider timelessness, then what happens? We are terrified of timelessness because the doer just doesn't have anything to do there. It only happens when you start doing something. And what is interesting is that when I started my meditation practice, I began to see that it was quite extraordinary to suddenly see thought as moving. Now, all of you now, by now, may have practiced meditation long enough to be really, really clear about the fact that thoughts come and go. Now, at the time, before I started meditation, I'd read that many, many times, you know, that thoughts are not you, they come and go, and so, but I hadn't really seen that properly. And it was extraordinary that one day on Euston Road, I remember waiting for the bus many years ago. And I remember suddenly I became aware that as I was looking at the cars going up and down, there was a whole commentary going on in myself which had nothing to do with me. It was really funny. I felt almost like laughing because there was somebody talking in me that had nothing to do with me. But I felt totally sane. There was nothing wrong with me. But I realized there's a whole world going on there that I'm not quite aware of. You know, when suddenly you begin to see that you're not living just with one or two people, you're living about hundreds of characters in there who have their own agenda, their own time-bound reality, their own goal, their own aim, their own fear and desires, their own anxiety about the future, and you've got the perfectionist here, the lazy one, the cultured one, and the brutal one. You got the refined one and the crude one. I mean, so many of those creatures in there. So it's not just me as one person in this body, but a whole array of characters that had their own world. So that's really a mind stopper. It definitely stopped my mind completely, and I looked at it and that's very interesting. And then I started, and I did a retreat, a meditation retreat after that, and began. And that's when I really got to know in depth, because it was new. Because when something is new, as you know, it's you're always much more vital with it. And that's why we love new things, because we don't know how to keep this vitality in ourselves unless something is new. And so in meditation, we begin to get in touch with a reality that is not limited by time. You begin to see that your mind, your world, is agitated by this this existence of time. And it's agitated because what it does, it keeps creating. You're constantly creating and concocting things. And I still remember reading a passage of Krishnamurti's teaching in which he said, thoughts are fears. I was ripe to hear this because suddenly I got intensely very excited at the thought of checking out what my thoughts were doing, because I had a sense of that's true and I can trust, I trust his teaching. I trusted his teaching. And then as I examined my thought, I began to see that most of my thinking, when I really investigated quite thoroughly my thinking, most of the thinking was caused by my anxiety about the future, by my fear of the present moment, what was going to happen or what could happen or what had happened and wished to happen. It was just agitated by a lot of thinking. All influenced, generated by this response to time. You know, response to the past, into the present, back, you know, further into the future. So that was quite amazing to suddenly realize that, do I have to do that? You know, there's this question. Do I have to be stuck with that? I mean, is there another way to live? It was quite terrifying. It's like suddenly you realize you've been living in a little kind of rabbit hole and there's a chance of living in a mansion. And it was quite terrifying. And one little room, you're quite comfortable with that, but the idea of having 150 rooms is a bit terrifying. So... So when we, when we get in touch with this quality of mindfulness awareness, we begin to see how time is created. It's very simple, you know, and what we add onto what we create. So we create and we recreate and we, you know, because time is there anyway. As I said, as you all know, there's days and night, there's sun. You know, the sun at its zenith, and then we can see all the planets, and we can, you know, we can see that there is a constant movement of this in this universe, constant change, constant, and there's a rhythm to it. It's beautiful rhythm, very harmonious. Now, if we stay in harmony with this rhythm, you know, everything is all right. What we do most of the time, we start playing God as well. You know, we decide that this rhythm is not good enough. We're going to have another one. But if it was a nice rhythm, that wouldn't be a problem. But when the rhythm, it begin to be the rhythm of worry, stress, me, and my little rabbit hole, worrying about the darkness of this rabbit hole, and worrying about what I'm going to be, and worrying what I'm going to do, and worrying about what to do with me now, in this very moment, when everything is perfectly all right, but in this very moment, you spoil it completely by just being focused somewhere else. That has nothing to do with this alive energy of mindfulness. With the mind, when it's not blocked, filtered, veiled, obscured by mental states, thoughts, mood, feelings, and so on. Now, there are some mental states and thoughts which are enhancing this reality, such as love and compassion, beauty, spiritual qualities usually, selflessness, generosity, loving kindness, you know. Now, if we touch to those, then they become filters again. They obscure the mind. These qualities come through naturally when the mind is in this timeless quality. Yeah, it does. It's quite extraordinary. You can surprise yourself when the mind is not stuck in your kind of thought conditioned by time reality. Then you find that there is an extraordinary thing that happens. You begin to see that your mind is not just limited by the size of your skull or your brain or your neurons or your or your mood. So in this timeless reality, when you begin to when you can see the movement of change of your thoughts, of your mood, of your feeling, of everything that you experience, then there is, what is it that knows all this? What is it that is constantly aware? It's like there is a flow, but there is also that which sees, which is not moving with it. It wouldn't be able to see the flow if it was moving. There's like a backdrop of stillness, a backdrop of silence. It's always here, pardon me. Here. Now, to be in the present is a great blessing, because before you can be in the present moment, you have to deal with that which prevents you from being here and now. You know, you have to give space, room to all the aspect of this human experience that is terrified to be still. Terrified to stop moving. You know, our nature, our instinctual nature, knows that it's going to die at some point. It knows that it needs to survive. It knows that it must survive at any cost. And for that, it needs to move. You know, that's why we're challenging every instinctual fears when we take refuge in stillness. You know, we are really giving quite a test to this kind of, you know, part of our brain is called the reptilian brain, which is just about surviving and killing if necessary to survive, you know. Sometimes we feel anxious about being angry people or furious or, you know, really heated up type that just lose their temper all the time or... But we do have a brain that is also informing us to survive. And it's a pretty, ruthless one. You know. That's what makes people kill, to survive. So one thing that we discover that becomes very apparent in our meditation practice is that the one that creates time is this, strong identification with me being in control, me being in charge, and me, unfortunately, is a bundle of fears. If it was a bundle of love, well, so what? We wouldn't even want to liberate ourselves, would we? I think probably that's what the devas are about, the devadas, you know, the angels. They're probably a bundle of love, and in Buddhism, they just don't care about liberation, apparently. They just stay there for eons and eons of time, just playing harp and guitars and lutes and singing and sort of dancing and feeling love, pulsating with pink love in their heart. But we tend to identify with things that make us utterly miserable. That's a problem. This is why wisdom is very important in the human realm, because we need to know... We need to be discriminative, in other words. We need to know what's what. You notice when you love and you have lots of metta, you can accept everything. Even somebody can, you know, walk over you and boulders at you. If you're just filled with love, well, you wouldn't mind at all. It will just... It's like the Buddha, you know, offered himself to a tigress, I think, because she was looking for some food for her little cubs. And so he just kind of in past life, before when he was a bodhisattva, he just said, well, take me, eat me, you know, if that. So this is like ultimate compassion. Now, we're not there yet, are we? We have to acknowledge that we're not quite there yet. So we need to know what to find out what blocks the way to be able to offer ourselves to a little kind of tigress cubs. So going back to timelessness, this quality of presence, it's so essential and it's such a beautiful quality and it's so fearless and it's so immense and so free that it's not really, how can I say, you can't dismiss it, you can't just walk past it without being sort of interested in what's going on. But it takes some work. I mean, it doesn't happen by itself. We all love to hear about timelessness, eternity, and so on, you know. But when it comes to what we need to do, we're not prepared for that because it requires a certain amount of letting go, a certain amount of relinquishment, renunciation. Do you realize how many things we have to let go in each moment when we are taking refuge in awareness? You know, Ajahn Sumedho, if I remember correctly, he said, mindfulness really, you have to be very, I can't quote him exactly, but he said, mindfulness, you know, you have to be very confident in mindfulness because you're not like arguing and getting, you know, yes, no, yes, yes, no. You can just sit there. People think, oh, nothing is happening. When lots of things is happening inside, I can tell you. You're just mindful. You're just aware of what's going on. And because you don't express it, people think, oh, this person is not thinking, not interested, not bothered, and so on. So mindfulness, you have to pay a little price for it. Because once you become more the witness, then you're stepping back. You're not just fully engaged in the way we are accustomed to. We are fully engaged with mindfulness, but in a different way. It's an engagement which is much broader. It's not just an engagement with what is of reactivity. It's a response. It's an ability to respond. In fact, the word responsible, you could say, it's the ability to respond, to be with the situation, not with our anxiety and our fear, but with the natural wisdom and compassion which is here with us at any time when we are not creating this, you know, all sorts of things on the screen of the mind, you know, when we can learn to empty the mind. Empty the mind, and it's actually quite. I said at first it takes some work to get there, but it's actually very immediate. So it's a way of speaking when I say it takes works to get there, but the actual active action of presence is immediate, right here, right now, at this very moment. You can know you're present just by the very fact you know you're sitting. You can hear the sound of my voice, the sound of people coughing, the sound of a little baby that was crying. You know, all this, you're aware. And this quality of awareness is so difficult to discover because we are always, we are used to know things. Once we hold the things, whether it's holding it in our hands or as an idea, as a concept, or as an object, we know. It's difficult to know something that is no thing, nothing, you know. And yet it's not nothing. It's the fullness of our mind, so it's not nothing at all. And it doesn't, you know, the world is not very interested in that quality of mindfulness that brings that contact, connect you with this timeless reality, which is not bound by thoughts, not bound by perception, not bound by what creates time, you know, what creates, has a rhythm, has a rhythm of change. So it's already there. But what we create on that, instead of taking refuge in the timeless quality of our mind, we want to control. We want to go back and recreate in the way that is comforting, reassuring. When you are more confident in your in being empty, letting the mind present, being present, empty, you don't know what's going to happen next. You might even have fear. You might even experience panic. But you can actually be with fear and panic and know that it's just like a cloud coming across your mind. And some of the clouds are a bit heavy. Others are little kind of white little puffs. But that's all they are. Most of the time we pick them up and we try to reshape them. We try to make them rain when they don't want to rain. We will try to push them out of away in one direction. If only the wind could push them to the east instead of the west, then I wouldn't have all this smoke coming over my house, or I wouldn't have all this stuff coming my way, you know. But in the timeless realm, you don't exclude time. You don't, you know, it's not a process of exclusion. It's a process of inclusion. It's like in when the mind is recognizing its timeless qualities, then you recognize also its time, you know, the existence that is in time, you know. And then you use this quality of awareness to deal with the time-bound reality in the way that is going to free yourself from the delusion that are produced by our fear of time, our fear of change, our fear of losing control. Isn't it such a kind of relief to know that things are changing when we don't like them? When something is bothering you, what a relief to think, oh my God, at least she's going to go at 3 o'clock. Or aversion, that's one response to time, that we don't, you know, when things get difficult. And then the other one is that when we really like something, I'm sure I don't need to ask you to know what we do with that. We cling, we want them, we possess things that we like, we threaten them if they make any signs of moving away or out of our control. And then we tell them how wonderful they are. And then they make another sign of maybe being out of control and start brutalizing them physically, mentally. We're quite refined in that respect. We can brutalize ourselves too. If you sit still more than 15 minutes, I'm just going to stop meditating. If you make, don't you see this? You make a program of meditation immediately. Mara, which is another word for death, okay? Mara comes along and wants you to stop your practice immediately. In very subtle ways, you spend the day busying out yourself, and finally you realize you haven't meditated for the last year. You've been thinking about it and really moaning about the fact that you couldn't do it, complaining to the neighbors, friends, up to the point where they're sick of you. But you haven't done your meditation, you know. So Mara has been very successful. Mara is death. It's the kind of thing that wants you to be reborn all the time into something. So it's a time creator and time destroyer, you know. So the death realm, the deathless realm, is actually very boring in comparison with the death realm. Very boring for our ego, for ourself, for what we call me. You know, imagine yourself saying to yourself, well, for the next month, I'll do nothing for 1 month. I'll just sit in my room for 1 month doing nothing. Don't think about it, feel it. Go down to your solar plexus and feel what it will be like. Because the ideal is that, oh, that would be so nice to get away from the kids and the husband and the wife, granny and my job. It would be wonderful. Yes, but everything in you is kind of reprogramming themselves already to be many much more busy than you would normally. It's a strange predicament we're part of. You know, we tend to do this. Our fears, the creator of our thoughts, creator of time, psychological time, you know, is a real it's a great source of suffering for us. So it's really worthwhile to come to that, you know, to understand what is this deathless, timeless quality of the mind. You know, what is it? The stillness, the silence, not a silence which is dead, or the silence that reject everything to be silent, but the silence that includes the noises, that includes the beautiful sound and terrible sound, that includes everything. So what is it that, you know, that prevents us from relaxing into that whole quality of the heart? Well, if you look closely, you'll see it's really Mara. Mara. Mara is it's a word which depicts the aspect of the mind that perpetuate delusion. It's constantly churning up things to make you frightened, to make you regretful, to make you anxious and worry. In fact, it has an army. Mara has its own army in the scriptures. And it has an army. Its army is a sloth and torpor, worry and anxiety, fear, and a few others kind of miserable entities. And so Mara comes along, and that's the kind of forces and energy that says to you, you know, oh no, you can't sit down now, you can't just commune with the timeless Ram, there's this to do and this to do, and suddenly everything you've forgotten, you remember to do. The moment we're just about to let go and relax into a timeless Ram, suddenly your agenda just jumps at you. And things you haven't done for several years, you start thinking about, that would be a really good time to start. Because of this fear of relaxing into this timeless experience, you know. So unfortunately, in this human life, we can't always be in the timeless realm, otherwise we wouldn't be able to function properly. You know, even the great mystics, even the great the great spiritual beings still had to eat and go to the bathroom and do all sorts of things that their body required because of change, the nature of change. You eat, you have got to go to the toilets, you get sick, etc. You know, you have to get up and lie down, you have to move the body so it can continue to function properly and so on. What I'm saying right now is not that we have to, you know, sort of suddenly spend our whole life, you know, sitting in our room, timelessly abiding in timelessness till the end. You will notice, you try to do this and you will find that. What is it that keeps driving you? Food, one thing, you need to eat, and so on. So even if you abide in timelessness, you will still experience time. You don't need to worry. But we don't need to make more of it than necessary. We don't need to create out of this experience of time a reality of misery, a reality of pain, It's not necessary. Mm-hmm. So, I was talking with one of the senior monks this morning, and I was mentioning about giving a talk on time and timelessness, and I was saying something like, you know, I'm not sure I'm prepared for that, and sort of, and then he gave me a little kind of snippets of one of an extract of T.S. Eliot poems, which I knew with a beautiful description of what it takes to be in this timeless realm. So I have to remember. To apprehend, and I have a French accent, so, you know, I won't get the sort of the intonation exactly right, but you'll probably understand what I'm saying. To apprehend the point of intersection of the timeless with time is an occupation of the saint. Not an occupation either, but something given and taken in a lifetime death in love, ardor, and selflessness, and self-surrender. That gives you a little idea of what it takes to be there. I think I'll conclude on this.